as you can see, we're beginning with a question, so if you want to answer the question, then raise your hand and you can answer, or you have input about it. So we'll do this. Some of this will be interactive, and so if you know the answer to the question or have a comment that you can make, then you can, you're welcome to make it. So this is a little bit less formal than services, so if you'd like to participate interactively, you're welcome. So the reason that I chose to do this particular Bible study was because of the fact that we live in a time where it seems like current events are taking place that are applicable to the prophetic outline of what's going to happen at the end of the age, and this particular situation is as you'll see, it is applicable, and it is interesting to look at what's going on here. So, and this first slide is the reason basically I chose to do this particular study as opposed to another one. And the question is, what is the Arab Spring? So anybody know what that is? The Arab Spring. Yes, Bob? That's right. So you have, you know, for decades, the Middle East has been a certain way. And you've had certain rulers in power, and all of that has begun to change this spring, with beginning with Tunisia. A fruit dealer was not happy with the deal he was getting, and so he lit himself on fire and died in a fire, and it seemed like that was the spark that set everything going. And, you know, you see the term Arab Spring, and you think, well, that's pretty benign, that really, you know, spring and the flowers are going to blossom and, you know, the butterflies, and it's all real nice, but that's not how it's all worked out, unfortunately. People thought that the dictators would fall from power and democracy would blossom and we're going on to a wonderful new world, and that's just not the way that it's worked out. These are the countries that have been affected by the Arab Spring. And it runs from Mauritania over in Africa all the way across North Africa, Sudan, Yemen, and all the way out to central China. So that's a vast territory, but that all of that territory has been affected to one extent or another. As you think about the countries, you've just had elections here in the last week or so, and they've elected more of an Islamist-leaning ruling party. You've got Algeria's facing problems. You've got Tunisia's already fallen, and they've replaced their leader. Libya's replacing their leader. Egypt is replacing their leader. And the question is, where is all this going to go? How is it all going to end up? We really don't know how it's all going to work out. It's, you know, sometimes when something happens, you think, well, it's going to work out a certain way, and it doesn't end up working out the way you thought it would. And that's the situation we see in the Middle East. Which direction is it going to go? For me personally, I have some real fears, because the people that helped to overthrow Libya, they're very much tied into Al-Qaeda. If you look at what's taking place with the elections in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood is very much a very influential party in that part of the world, and they're dedicated to the destruction of Israel. They've not relinquished that particular part of the platform of their party. So you've got these things going on, and the way it looks to me is something similar to what the Apostle John saw on the shore of the island of Patmos. He was God opened his mind to see certain things in vision, and he saw a beast rising out of this raging sea. And what we seem to have in the Arab world is a raging sea, and something's going to come out of it. What? We don't know exactly. But it makes me think that there is something that is going to come out of it, very probably. And so it makes you begin to think the end is near. You know, you see this sign occasionally. And today's world events are accelerating toward a climatic conclusion. And they are doing so in a subtle way. People don't see what's going on behind the scenes, who is the power and the force behind some of the things that are going on. And who could be behind the subtle events of the end time? And it is the one that we know as Satan. As you look at how things unfold at the end of the age, Satan and the demons are very much a part of that. And as you realize from Genesis chapter 3, it tells us that Satan was more subtle and more crafty than any living creature. He was more subtle and crafty, and he still is. And Satan, and God restrains Satan, and God allows Satan leeway to do his work at the right time. God controls things and holds things back until it's time. And it seems like God has allowed Satan to have more leeway, influence things in the direction he wants it to go. In this study and the one to follow, we're going to take a look at one of the three key players in what's going to unfold at the end of the age. We're going to examine the player that will very probably be the catalyst to inspire and motivate the other two players. And so the topic we're going to look at today is the King of the South. And there will be a second part to this. The question that I have for you is, where did the terms King of the South and King of the North originate? Where do they come from? Where do those titles come from? Now, generally, we could say the Bible, but more specifically, where do they come from? Richard? Yes, that's two things. One is they come from Daniel 11, where both of those kings are mentioned, and they originated with the generals that succeeded Alexander the Great. His empire was divided into four parts, and we know that the King of the South, does anybody know what general that the King of the South is associated with? The Ptolemies. Egypt and the Ptolemies. And how about the King of the North? The Seleucids, Seleucus. And so both of those empires are talked about extensively in Daniel chapter 11, and it's quite interesting what you find there, all the different prophecies, and much of that prophecy has come to pass, but there are portions of it beginning at a certain point as you go through the prophecy that are going to unfold in our time. To begin today, let's go to Daniel chapter 10. Daniel chapter 10. As we look at the scriptures here, and it is interesting what we, what Daniel was able to see and relate to all of us. Daniel chapter 10. It says in the third, beginning in verse 1, it says, "In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar. The message was true, but the appointed time was long, and he understood the message and had understanding of the vision." So he sees this prophecy that is going to unfold, and it covers a long span of time, going from the time of Alexander the Great and his generals on down to the very end of the age. So there is a very long span that is being talked about there. He says in verse 2, "In those days I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. I ate no pleasant food, no meat or wine came into my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled." So he was did not eat, and the angel had come to him and given him a vision, and he did not understand all of that was being revealed to him. Let's go down to verse 10 in Daniel chapter 10. It says, "Suddenly a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palms of my hands. And he said to me, 'O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you, and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you.' While he was speaking this word to me, I stood trembling. Then he said to me, 'Do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come because of your words. So he had begun to pray to God and ask for God's understanding. And God said, the angel is relaying to him that his words had been heard and that from the very first day he began to utter them. Sometimes we go through things in our lives and we ask God for his intervention and his mercy, and it goes on and drags out, and we wonder why. And we wonder, is God even hearing me? Well, this tells us that God does hear us, but God does not always immediately intervene. And sometimes there are things holding things up as well. He says in verse 13, "But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me." Now, this is a demonic being associated with the kingdom of Persia. And that demonic being was holding things up. "So that demonic being withstood me 21 days, and behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left alone there with the kings of Persia." So it's talking about demonic, you have the king of Persia who's a physical being, but you also have demonic beings associated with that kingdom. And these beings had slowed things up, had stopped this angel from being able to get to Daniel and to reveal things. So Michael had to come and help him, it says here. It says in verse 14, "Now I have come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision refers to many days yet to come." So what's going to happen to God's people, the physical people and the spiritual people? What's going to happen to them at the end of the age? "When he had spoken such words to me, I turned my face toward the ground and became speechless. And suddenly, one in heaven, the likeness of the sons of men, touched my lips. Then I opened my mouth and spoke, saying to him who stood before me, 'My Lord, because of the vision, my sorrows have overwhelmed me, and I have retained no strength.'" So he saw what was going to take place. He saw that it was going to be a very, very bad time. And, he was speechless. Verse 17, "For how can this servant of my Lord talk with you, my Lord, as for me no strength remains in me now, nor is any breath left in me? Then again the one having the likeness of a man touched me and strengthened me, and he said, 'O man, greatly beloved, fear not, peace be to you, be strong, yes, be strong.'" So he says, be strong and under these difficult circumstances. And then he says in verse 20, "Then he said, 'Do you know why I have come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. And when I have gone forth, indeed the prince of Greece will come.'" So you've got another being that's going to be there and going to he's going to have to fight with as well. "But I will tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth. No one upholds me against these except Michael, your prince." So Michael is going to be there to help him as he battles against these evil spirit beings. Chapter 11, verse 1 says, "Also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him." And then he talks about these kings that are to come on the scene. So he's telling them that there are these hostile spirit forces that he's battling. So these spirit forces are involved. They were involved in ancient times, and they are still involved and going to be involved in very much in the things that take place as we come to the end of the age. So we come to Daniel 11, and it is the longest and most detailed prophecy in the Bible, and many things that have already taken place there and some that are yet to come. Daniel 11 actually focuses, as we've said, on two kings, the king of the north and the king of the south, and we've already talked about their origins, deriving from those who succeeded Alexander the Great and took over his empire. Now, as you think about Daniel 11 and the kings of the north and the kings of the south, who's the most infamous king of the north? Who is the most infamous of the kings of the north? Does anybody know who that was? Steve? Right, Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus the Epiphanes. And Antiochus is talked about in Daniel 11, beginning in verse 30. Daniel 11, beginning in verse 30. And on the left is a coin with Antiochus's face on it, and then on the right is is the image that might have been placed in the temple, a statue of Jupiter Olympus. And Daniel 11, verse 30, It says, "For ships from Cyprus shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant." So Antiochus Epiphanes invaded Egypt. He was defeated. And as a result of his defeat, he was enraged. And as he came north from Egypt, then he turned his rage against God's people in the area of Judea. This all took place in 168. He came in a rage against the holy people, as prophesied in Daniel 11, verse 30. And, you know, this prediction had been made several hundred years before it actually took place. He's the king who eventually sets up the abomination of desolation, this abomination that was placed in the temple and prophesied about in verse 31. It says in verse 31, "And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices." They're going to stop the daily offering of sacrifices in the temple and place there the abomination of desolation. So they will place that abomination in the temple of God. And this was only a forerunner of what is going to take place in the latter days before Christ return. We know from Matthew chapter 24, verse 15, it says that there's going to be a future abomination of desolation, that abomination is going to be set up once again. And if that does come to pass, then we better watch out, because the end is most definitely near. It says in verse 36 of Daniel 11 that that Antiochus was a king who shall do according to his own will. He was very willful in what he wanted to do. And Antiochus certainly did this in his own time. He forced upon the Jews Greek culture and religion. He sought to stamp out the true religion and to force the Greek culture upon them. He outlawed the religion of the Jews. They were forbidden to practice it on pain of death. And as you look at Antiochus, Antiochus had two crowns, a political crown and a spiritual crown. He was not only king, but he was a priest. He fulfilled both roles. And it's going to be fulfilled again in the future. And Christ, as I said, prophesied about this future abomination of desolation. And when you put all of this prophecies together, you realize that when that's fulfilled, there's going to be a third player in the end time. You have you'll have the king of the north, you'll have the king of the south, and you'll also have another religious ruler who's going to influence things. A physical head of state, and there's also going to be a religious leader that will greatly influence things. Let's go to verse 36 of Daniel 11 and just read a few verses here. It says, "Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what he has determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall exalt himself above them all." He shall exalt himself above them all. And so Antiochus did that in his time, and a individual that will come on the scene in the future is going to do the same thing. We know him from other scriptures as the man of sin. The man of sin, and he's mentioned in the 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. He's going to come on the scene, and Paul talks about his coming. Talks about a great apostasy, and this man coming on the scene. It says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3, it says, "Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God." Now, will there be an actual temple? I don't know. I think we've thought that there would be some sort of a temple or some sort of a daily sacrifice set up and offered. But as you think about things now, where is the temple of God today? Is there a temple of God? Most assuredly there is. You are the temple of God. The temple of God is, at this particular time, the church. The temple of God is the church. And I can't say how it's all going to play out in the physical world, but there is a temple of God in the sense that it is the church. We are the temple of God. And what is going to happen is just as this Antiochus Epiphanes came to the literal temple of God there and sought to desecrate it in his time, you're going to have an individual that is you're a political leader and a religious leader, and they're going to come against the church of God. And they're going to seek to defile it. And when they seek to impose upon you, outlaw your religion and seek to impose upon you their religion, you can no longer keep the Sabbath and the holy days and those kinds of things, then the temple of God is being desecrated. And he's going to seek for you to cave in and accept this false god and their false religion. And so he's going to desolate the church of God spiritually. He's not going to be in the church, but he is definitely going to impact the church just as Antiochus Epiphanes did. And so he's going to seek to exercise all the religious authority that God does, going to blaspheme God and going to bring a great deal of pressure to bear upon the people of God. And I think that, and as we'll look at in other studies, not in this particular one, what you're going to find out is there is a sorting out process going on. And there is, you're going to find that there are individuals who are not committed to God. They know the truth, but they're not committed to God. And they're going to have to go through a very challenging test to find out whether they are committed. And basically, it's going to come down to they're either going to join with the beast and his religious point of view, or they're going to die. It's not going to be pleasant. And so that is yet to come, and it's going to very powerfully affect the Church of God. And so you can be thankful now. We can meet in peace. We can honor God. We have a place to meet, and we can congregate together, but that's not always going to be the case. Now let's go to Daniel 11, verse 40. Daniel 11, verse 40. And you don't need to necessarily turn there. I'll just give you the gist of what it says. It says there that the king of the south will push at him, that is, the king of the north. The king of the south will push at the king of the north. That is, he will provoke the king of the north and through isolated attacks, and that's exactly what is happening today. The king of the south is pushing at the king of the north with isolated attacks. Not a full-blown war. It is a full-blown war, but it's not a conventional war like we're used to, where you've got two armies on the field fighting each other. But these attacks are taking place. They've been going on for quite some time, maybe dating all the way back into the 1970s. And today, as my title indicates, we're going to try to better understand the King of the South. And the question I have for you is, is the King of the South one particular nation? Is the King of the South one particular nation? Yes. Why not? Okay. Okay, you say no. Okay, that's good. But any reason why you say no? Right. Right. There's going to be a group of nations that will come together. Just like with the King of the North, it's going to be a group of nations. Remember, it talks about 10 kings. All right. So it is not going to be one nation. Now, one nation may be more influential than the other nation that may be influential in that group of nations. Just as with the King of the North, we've always thought that one nation is going to be more influential than the others. And it is probably the most influential nation in the European Union today, and that is Germany. But if you look in the Middle East, where is the power, the most influential nation right now? We'll see. Is it Egypt? Is it Iran? We'll see. So we have the down here is where the King of the South is located. all this area down in here, and the king of the north is up here. And so you have the king of the north up, the king of the south down below, and you have the king of the north up there. And in general, that's how that's all going to unfold. We know from prophecy that, which we're not going to go into to today, that the king of the north in its final version is going to be closely aligned with the old Roman Empire, and he's going to be closely aligned with a strange religious player. Talks about this particular religious individual riding like a woman riding a beast, and it'll be a political entity joined with a religious entity. And why would the king of the north want to be aligned with and controlled by a religious entity? Why would the king of the north want to be aligned religiously with a influential religious group? Why would they do that? Yes. Okay, so they're going to fight the king of the south, and religion will be part of it. But as you have these 10 kings, what's going to hold them together? Religion's going to be part of what binds them together. You know, it's called iron and miry clay. It doesn't hold together very well. Religion is going to work to help to hold it together. And also the second reason is because of the nature of the king of the south, it may force a religious alliance between those kings who will form the king of the north. They will come together and work together religiously to fight against the king of the south. So we know the people of Europe are in the north, and we know that the people of the Arabs and Islam are in the south. And let's take a little bit closer back, look at the background of the king of the south. So what is the religion of the king of the south? Islam. It's Islam. And so Islam is the religion of the king of the south. What is the holy book of the king of the south? It's the Quran. It is the Quran. The Quran is considered the full and final revelation from God. The Muslims know as Allah. And the followers of Muhammad say that the Quran, the revelation to Muhammad by Gabriel, supposedly is God's final message for the people. The Bible is not the final message, but the Quran. Unlike the Bible, which consists of many books, the Quran consists of 114 chapters. Each of those chapters is called a surah. There are 114 surahs that make up the Quran. Another question is this. Is Islam a religion of peace? Is Islam a religion of peace? If you remember back to 9/11, we heard over and over again from those who are our political leaders that Islam is a religion of peace. And there are peaceful individuals in Islam, but as far as the religion as a whole, it is not a religion of peace. Because there's a polar opposites that you'll see here in a moment. You have two houses in Islam. One of those houses is called Dar al-Salam. That is the house of Islam. The house of Islam. And that's made up of all of the followers of Muhammad. But there's another house that's called Dar al-Hab, which means the house of war. And that's made up of all of those non-believers or infidels. So if you do not, you know, you have not accepted Allah and Muhammad as his prophet, you are an infidel. And you are part of Dar al-Hab. All right? And all of the people that are Muslims are considered Dar al-Islam. And so there is a distinction between them. And the Quran tells Muslims in regard to infidels or non-believers that they are to make war against all non-believers. They are to make war against all non-believers. Here are some quotes from the Quran. The first one says, "Fight them until all opposition ends and until all submit to Allah." That's until everybody has submitted to Allah. Okay, that means we're not stopping till everybody submits. A second point is when you clash with the unbelieving infidels and smite their necks until you overpower them, killing and wounding them, you are commanded by Allah to continue carrying out jihad against the unbelieving infidels until they submit to Islam. So they are to make war against the infidels until all they've conquered the whole world. And you have to realize that that is the mindset that's in play here with Islam. Now, are they making war against the infidels? This is Beslan, Chechnya, a few years ago, where they took over a school. And you see all the body bags of teachers and students and those who were killed at that time. For all of us, it would be an abomination for us to take over a school and try to use them as a way of bringing about our goal of conquering the world. But from the Islamic perspective, you can kill women, children, old people, you can lie, you can steal, you can do any underhanded thing in order to achieve your purpose. And that's we all find that reprehensible, but that's where that religion comes from. A couple of other quotes from the Quran. It says, "Fight and kill the unbelievers wherever you find them. Take them captive. Lie in wait, beleaguer them and ambush them using every strategy of war." So lying is a strategy of war. Deception is a strategy of war. And if you have to put your rockets in a Christian church or in a hospital, then you should, because that's just a stratagem of war. And you're going to use it against your opponents. A second quote says, "Prepare against the infidels whatever arms and weaponry you can muster so that you can terrorize. They are your enemy and they are Allah's enemy." So you can make war against women, children, elderly, civilians, anyone who is not a believer. Now, this is just the reality of what's going on in the world. And all of this traces back to the founder of the religion, the man we know as Muhammad. As a warrior himself, Muhammad ordered 27 military campaigns, and he personally commanded 9 of them before he died in 632. Muhammad ruled the people he conquered, not only as a prophet, but also as a head of state. He was a prophet and a king over those he conquered in battle. And when he first began, he tried to win over the Jews, he tried to win over the Christians, and he didn't win over either one of them. But you do find elements of Christianity in Islam, as well as elements of the Jewish thoughts in there. For instance, they don't eat pork, but interestingly, they eat shellfish. Don't get that. So anyway, that's part of their religion. He soon found out that he couldn't win converts from either the Christians or Jews, and that angered him, and so he turned negative toward them, and he didn't choose Saturday as the day of worship or Sunday, he chose Friday. He chose Friday. He died in 632, but he had begun something that continued on after his death. And it was a short time, and as you look at where he began, they began in Mecca and Medina, and began from there in the 630s. And then Islam spread out to the east and to the west, into Egypt and further out that way. And by 661, 750, it spread all the way to Spain and into the Mideast and on into China. It's expanded very rapidly. And they eventually conquered all of Spain, and they were pushing on beyond this to a place called Tours is the better way for me to say it, and because I'm not that good with French. So they pushed up into the area of France, and basically whether we would be Muslims or not was determined by what took place at the Battle of Tours. And you can see the full extent of the Empire of Islam running from into central China all the way to Spain. And it expanded very fast. But they came into Spain and they were seeking to overrun Europe. They came up into there and they met the French, the Franks at the Battle of Tours. And the Battle of Tours, God was merciful upon us. He did not want us to all be Muslims. That was not part of His plan. And the Muslim tide was turned back at Tours, and they all went back across the Pyrenees and remained in Spain until the Spaniards drove out the Moors in 1492. Interestingly, we all enjoy croissants. Croissants, you notice what their shape is. It's like a crescent. And the bakers of France said, oh, victory is ours. And so they came up with this little confection called croissants. And so we enjoy them to this day. So when you look at croissants in the future, it all dates back to 732 and the defeat of the Moors at the Battle of Tours. After that battle, descendants of Charles Martel, who was the leader of the Franks at the Battle of Tours, his descendants were the most powerful in the kingdom of the Franks, and eventually one of his descendants by the name of Charlemagne, or Charles the Great, was elected to be the new Roman emperor. And what empire was founded with his crowning? The Holy Roman Empire. So it's an establishment of the Roman, a resurrection of the Roman Empire, and it's the Pope put his blessing on it, so it's supposedly holy. But as you look at its history, it's anything but. But that's the way it was. So in 800 A.D., Pope Leo III crowned Charlemagne and bestowed on him the title Roman Emperor, and the Holy Roman Empire was founded. The Pope then used the armies of the King of the North, Charles the Great, or Charlemagne, was the King of the North at that time, and he used them to fight and thwart the advance of Islam, the King of the South. So what did it take? It took a resurrection of the Roman Empire in order to turn back Islam. It took a resurrection of the Roman Empire to turn it back. It's a fascinating thing, and we might ask, is it going to take a resurrection of the Roman Empire to turn back the King of the South in the future? In fact, as you look at history, you realize that in the case of several resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire, the very reason why there was a resurrection was to turn back the King of the South. And, for instance, why did we have the Crusades? Why did Pope Urban II call for a crusade? Why is that? To free Jerusalem. The Islam had conquered Jerusalem, and that was the holy city, so they wanted to get it back for Christendom, and so crusades were called. And the purpose was the King of the South was pushing at the King of the North, and the King of the North was pushing back at the King of the South. They eventually did conquer Jerusalem, but about 100 years after it was reconquered, it was went back to the Muslims, and Islam controlled Jerusalem. It was renamed Al-Quds and was controlled for nearly 800 years. As you look at the Empire of Islam, it ruled the South for over 1,200 years, and it did not come to an end until the end of World War I, when the Ottoman Empire came to an end. And so it was a very, you know, you're all the way back to Muhammad for 1,200 years that empire had existed. So the caliphate was dissolved after World War I. So what's the next significant event in history from the most significant event that took place after World War I as far as the Middle East is concerned? What was it? We've got to keep moving on. Okay, 1948. What took place in 1948 in the Middle East? Israel was established. So Israel was established, and as soon as they established the nation and it was recognized by the United States, the Muslims went to war against the Jews and were defeated. They, in their defeat, they were greatly humiliated, and the Jewish nation was allowed to exist in their midst. They sought to destroy them, and they lost, and were even more humiliated. But at least they said, "We control Jerusalem." So do they still control Jerusalem today? When did they lose Jerusalem? 1967, in the Seven-Day War, they lost Jerusalem. The Jews took Jerusalem back. And this, from a Muslim perspective, this was the straw that broke the camel's back. This was just unacceptable. And the Jews had taken control of the city of Jerusalem. And with the loss of Jerusalem to the infidels, a major question came up in Islam. A major question came up. And does anybody know what the big question is? Any idea? It's this: why does Islam suffer defeat at the hands of the infidels? Why does Islam suffer defeat at the hand of the infidels? That is the big question. So they wanted to know, why are we losing? And they came to the conclusion that the reason they're losing is because they haven't been doing what they were commissioned to do by Allah. And that is to conquer the world. So they came to that conclusion. And so after coming to that conclusion, then from that point forward, then it has been the goal of Islam to conquer the world. That has been their goal. They are to fight all infidels until all are killed or all submit to Allah. They are to defeat those infidels and to set up the caliphate. This caliphate that is a Muslim world is what they're seeking to set up. So one of the first events that took place as they began to bring the world to its knees and under Islam was in 1972, when the Palestinians crept into the Olympic Village and killed a number of Jewish wrestlers and a policeman. And the new jihad, the new war on the infidels, had begun. And that was one of the first shots fired, and we've had more shots fired since that time. So all of this is taking place, and it's rather subtle. And one of the things that we have to realize about Islam is we don't understand. Our perspective from the West is if we are nice to them, they will be nice to us. But that's not their mindset. Their culture is an honor culture. And it means we have dishonored and disrespected them, and the only action they can take to restore their honor is to hit you back. And that's what they're doing. It's a matter of honor with them. And we in the West don't get that. We teach our kids, now don't hit. I know he hits you, but you're not to hit him back. Isn't that what we teach our kids? You're not to hit him back. Now, if he hits you really hard, maybe. If he hits you twice, you can punch him once. But, you know, we typically tell our kids, don't hit back. And that's how we operate from the West. And they just think your people are stupid. And we can take advantage of it because you have that mindset. So there is a subtlety and an irony in all of this, and it is Satan who transforms himself into an angel of light, and he influences things. He influenced Muhammad in writing the Quran, and he continues to influence things. And he's quite cunning, and he is hard at work in what's unfolding here before us. Ironically, Satan has used the same subtle method in deceiving even the USA. He's deceived people, and he continues to deceive. And he does it gradually. If you think about it, Islam does not have the military power to just overpower the West. So they have to do it gradually, subtly. What is the main way that Islam is winning today? Anybody have an idea? What's that? Population? Somebody said population. They basically are having babies faster than we are. So demographically, you're going to win. So, yes. Rich? And multiculturalism helps them to push their agenda and push things forward because we try to be nice. We have to be tolerant. Well, you can be tolerant to the point where it's foolish. And unfortunately, we are. Yes? They most certainly do. They use our own laws against us, our laws of the right of free speech and assembly and all of those kinds of things. They are being used against us. So, interestingly, in our recent history, we find that there have been three times in which there has been kind of an irony that has worked out with the King of the South. Let's look at irony number one. Irony number one. On the left, how many of you recognize this guy? The Shah of Iran. All right. For those who are really old, I should have asked James and those guys if they knew who that was. The Shah of Iran. And this fellow here, this is Ayatollah Khomeini. Now, the Shah of Iran was the ruler of Iran in 1962. He was installed by the United States and the CIA, and he had a good relationship with the United States. He basically ruled on our behalf. And unfortunately, not everybody was happy with him being in power. Most specifically, this man here by the name of Ayatollah Khomeini. So the Shah exiled Khomeini. He was exiled to Turkey, and then he eventually went to Iraq and then on to France, where he orchestrated a revolution against the Shah of Iran. And the Shah put down the Khomeini-influenced uprisings with force to try to be able to hold on to power. And so we backed him and supported him for a time, but that all changed when America stopped supporting the Shah. Does anybody remember back to who decided, whose administration decided to stop supporting the Shah of Iran? Carter. Yes. So in 1976, Jimmy Carter was elected to be the President of the United States. And Jimmy Carter came on the scene. He was supposedly a good Christian. He had a Christian outlook. And Carter's administration publicly sought Khomeini's friendship. They thought they were oppressed, and so they thought they were that the Shah was just a brutal dictator and oppressing these poor, peace-loving people. And so the Khomeini and the Iranian Revolution, which deposed the Shah, and he helped Khomeini get back in power. And when Khomeini got in power, what did he establish? He established a theocracy governed by Sharia law. The Carter administration supported all of this, not realizing what they were doing. And why would Carter do that? Why would his administration do that? Because they thought the Shah of Iran was an abuser of human rights because of his treatment of the revolutionaries. And interestingly, Ayatollah Khomeini ended up killing more people within the first year than the Shah had killed in 25 years. Not that I approve of killing, but you know, it didn't work out like you thought it was going to. So he took over, and what happened shortly thereafter? He helped him get in power, and what happened after that? The hostage crisis. Here we have hostages taken November 4th, 1979. The Carter administration realized their error when the Ayatollah Khomeini stormed the U.S. embassy and held 52 American hostages for 444 days. Excuse me. Does anybody realize what's happened in about the last week and a half? They've stormed the British embassy and ransacked it. I don't believe they took any hostages, but they did ransack it. So the result of this, these hostages taken for 444 days and 52 hostages were taken, it cost Carter his presidency. And Carter's action accelerated the current rise of the King of the South. Instead of being our friend, they proved to be our enemy. Basically, they looked at you as a dope for allowing this to take place. Hey, if they're going to let us do this, why not? Ironically, and contrary to the expected result, the U.S. actually helped promote the current rise of terrorism by helping Ayatollah Khomeini get into power. And President Carter and his administration didn't realize that they were being duped at that time. So it is interesting what takes place and what is taking place now. The second irony is the invasion. This followed on the heels of the first. As the Shah of Iran was being deposed, the U.S. enemy in the Cold War invaded Afghanistan. They figured, boy, these people are really weak. So they said, we can go ahead and invade in Afghanistan. And they did. So since the Soviets had been our enemies in the Cold War, the U.S. clandestinely supported the Taliban in Afghanistan. And in so doing, the U.S. helped strengthen and arm radical Islamists around the world. So we actually are helping all we think we're acting in our best interest, but we're actually, hastening our problems for ourselves, increasing the problems for ourselves. From the roots of the Soviet-Afghanistan war came the birth of Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, and Hamas, and other terrorist groups. Again, in a very subtle and ironic way, we helped establish the monster who's trying to destroy us. And it all led to probably the most momentous terrorist act in our history, and that is the attack on the Twin Towers. And at that point, then we felt we had been docile too long, and we actually began to take some action. But so these are all actions by the King of the South pushing at the King of the North. And their goal is to just take over the world and bring it to heel for Allah and Islam. That is the goal of Islam today. A question is, why do Muslims hate the West? That question was posed. And our intelligence service now knows our enemy, but most of our leaders do not. In 2006, the Pentagon assigned intelligence analysts to write a report about the source of Islamic extremism. They asked, what's driving these people? Why would would teenagers, young girls and boys, and with their whole life ahead of them, be willing to become suicide bombers? Why would people get a great education, become doctors and engineers with very successful lives, and then become suicide bombers? What's driving these people, they wanted to know. Do they have that much hatred, or is there more to it? The outcome of the research was not politically correct, but it was explosive information. And the information, which the media and our leaders have ignored because it's not politically correct in this multicultural world in which we live, what they found was that it wasn't just hatred of the Jews, the West, or the Jewish occupation of Palestine, which were the driving forces. Those are issues that we can solve. They aren't the driving force. The driving force is the Quran itself, the religion of Islam itself, straight out of the revelations given to Muhammad. The report was entitled Motivations of Muslim Suicide Bombers, and they realized that the extremist had not hijacked Islam, a peaceful religion. The truth was that the suicide bombers were just carrying out the dictates of the Quran. They're doing what the Quran tells them to do. And that brings us up to date on how Satan has subtly and ironically used even our own nation to help further the jihad against the infidel. So where do we go from here? What is the ultimate goal of the King of the South? Who is the King of the South? I think the ultimate goal reveals who the King of the South is. The ultimate goal of those leading the new Islamic jihad is to create a worldwide caliphate. A worldwide caliphate. That is an imperial Muslim state that encompasses the whole globe. That is the goal. And you can see where this player is coming on the scene. And eventually somebody's going to say, we're not going to give in to this, we're going to fight back, and you're going to develop another opposing body to try to resist it and thwart it. One thing is for sure, the king of the south is going to continue to push at the king of the north. And the pushing from the king of the south will continue until it forces a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. The king of the north will need glue to hold that loose confederation of 10 kings together to thwart the advance of the king of the south. And that glue will be the Roman Catholic Church. A recent quote from a leading Muslim cleric published on his website says, the prophet Muhammad was asked, what city will be conquered first, Constantinople or Rome? He answered, the city of Constantinople will be conquered first. And Constantinople was conquered in 1453. The other city, Rome, remains, but we hope and believe that it too will be conquered. Why is that? Why do they want to conquer Rome? The reason is because it has been the Roman Catholic Church that has rallied Christendom to fight Islam. In the Crusades, at Tours, at Lepanto, at Vienna, in all of those cases, the Pope rallied Christendom to drive Islam back. And they're going to have to rally again here at the end of the age to turn it back once again. This is all spoken of in Daniel 11, Matthew 24, and in the book of Revelation. So the king of the south is pushing, and he continues to push until all the prophecies concerning him are fulfilled. They all will be. And so we've looked at some past and present and future possibilities with the king of the south. So the next Bible study, we will discuss the third irony, and we will also discuss who may lead the king of the south. And with that, Bible study is done.